the Owlcast, the official podcast of ACS Athens. Listen to the exciting story of the American Community Schools of Athens. Check out what drives all the members of our international community of learners as we create the education of the future. Here's John Papadakis.
Welcome to this week's Owlcast. The importance of inclusive education is more prominent now as the international education community becomes more agile. Especially international schools, with their transient nature, are at the forefront of offering unique opportunities to students for learning and succeeding, regardless of their background, abilities, or differences. As the global conversation about inclusive education continues, we will definitely see methodologies and philosophies that promote equal access and participation in learning for all students, regardless of their gender, race, ethnicity, religion, socioeconomic status, language, learning style, or disability. This topic of inclusivity is essential for all to understand as it creates a fair, just, and equitable society that values diversity and promotes the full participation and inclusion of all individuals. At ACS Athens, one of the ways we promote inclusivity is through the Optimal Learning Program. The philosophy of a learning support program is not unique among American schools, but the OLP has evolved into a hotbed of innovation in learning methodologies, collaborations, and research that ultimately prepare students to become independent of the services and maximize learning outcomes by capitalizing on their individual needs, interests, and abilities. Today's guest has been an ACS Athens educator and special education specialist for 18 years now and heads the program that offers the teaching and learning tools and methodologies that enable all students to learn. Sarah Caldelli is the Optimal Learning Program Coordinator and advocate of inclusivity and child safety, continuing a long tradition of supporting students at their own pace and in their own way. With Sarah Caldelli, today we discuss educational tourism and empathy for international students, early childhood and elementary education, blurring the borders, what is optimal learning, and the use of AI tech tools in special ed. As always with our guests who are ACS Athens colleagues, by way of introduction, before we start our discussion about optimal learning and inclusion and all the other exciting things, I would like to ask what brought you to ACS Athens. You've been at our school for almost 18 years now, so take us, if you will, briefly through the path that led you to the blue gates of ACS Athens.
Wow, great question. I was at another international school before I came here. And then after that, I was in a Greek private school. And working in programs that weren't necessarily as I had hoped them to be, when I came here, it was evident that it was being built in a way that we could design, restructure, adjust, depending on the needs of the students. And so that not necessarily freedom, but that open-ended design that we just adapted to what the students needed was what really brought me here.
So you were in Greece when you started here.
I was in Greece, yes.
But originally you're from the States.
I'm not, actually.
Oh.
No.
Okay. Let's hear the news.
Okay.
For me, at least.
Okay. So I grew up in Greece. I went to several different schools. I went to two Greek private schools first, and then I went to a Greek public school, but that only lasted 3 months. My classroom was burnt down during those riots back in, I won't say when. And then in the middle of the year of my 10th grade, I was moved to an international school, and I completed my education there.
That's an adventure.
It was. I call it the educational tourism for a while, because I was moving around.
Which is not something unusual for our school.
For our school, no. So I really can relate to lots of our students when they say, you know, I've moved so many times. And I did too. I think I moved five schools My brother stayed in the same school for 13 years.
So five times for high school?
No. Five times throughout my whole educational experience. Yes. And I think that gives that also gives insight to how the school systems work. If you've been to Greek private, you've been to Greek public, I've been to two international schools now, this being my second. And I think it gives you a great overall understanding of how things are and how they should be.
That is something that I didn't know.
Yes.
Okay. So, and then you went to college, right?
Then I went to the States for my bachelor's. I went to Goucher College, and then I went directly for my master's to George Washington University in DC. And I did the two degrees back to back, and then I took the next flight out to come home.
It didn't occur to you to stay there for professional reasons?
No, I wanted to come home.
Interesting. As you said, you have a master's degree in early childhood special education, correct?
Indeed.
From George Washington University. What is so special in early childhood education, and why is it important in your view compared with the more traditional elementary education? As far as I know, the early childhood program is not something that you have to do as a child. It's a part of an extra step before you go to the elementary school, correct?
Well, not necessarily. And that's it was really fascinating at GW, because early childhood starts from zero. And so when I first sat in that classroom for my graduate studies, and they said, okay, it starts even before birth. It starts, they know, and if they've done all of the tests, they know what the infant might need. And then they can start telling, even from breastfeeding, whether speech therapy is going to be needed. So looking at a baby crawling, or looking at a baby, how they use if they're self-feeding infants, and then you can tell whether they need occupational therapy. And that was just mind-blowingly interesting. We had to get on the floor and write out the steps of when you need to crawl, what do you have to do? And there's so many steps involved, and that could mean physical therapy. So early childhood special education starts very young, and as early as you can get to children, the better it is. It's not a pre-step of elementary school. You've got to get to them early.
So I shouldn't have been surprised when I saw pregnant parents coming asking to see the school and, you know, trying to see what they're going to do with their unborn child. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is normal.
Yes, completely. Completely normal. If there is a normal, we're not quite using that word.
Yeah, of course. Yes. Of course. What's the word we're using?
Well, there isn't a normal, because absolutely everybody is different. So we just call it by the name of the person, because they're each different.
So you are the coordinator of the Optimal Learning Program of ACS Athens for 5 years now.
Yes.
Admittedly, both our colleagues, but also the parents of the students currently supported by the program, believe in the importance of the services we provide. What do we mean by optimal learning? In your opinion, what is optimal learning?
Optimal learning is looking at the student completely and holistically, and seeing what that particular learner needs, and then matching it up. That's why originally it was called the Optimal Match Program. And then taking what the student needs, taking their abilities, not their disabilities, and their strengths, and pairing them up with what we can offer them in the school setting.
So the program tries to, of course, mainstream the students.
Yes, we are in a mainstream.
But there are other models out there that they offer a much more differentiated approach to education, correct?
Yes.
In the age of EdTech and AI, what is or what could be optimal learning? I was listening to an interview of an EdTech scholar who said the big challenge nowadays is handling the frustration of learning with all the different tools, methodologies, changing paradigms and disruptions. How can we alleviate from our position as a school with the Optimal Learning Program, how can we alleviate the frustration of a neurodiverse student and get them excited about learning? What are your thoughts on this?
Okay, well, we have so many students who benefit from tech tools. For example, we have students who really struggle with the physical aspect of writing. And so we have voice to tech tools, And that takes away a lot of the pressure of you know, holding that pencil and writing for longer periods of time. And they can get their ideas out on paper, which is our ultimate goal.
That's one application of technology that has developed lately.
Yes, yes. And then even we have students who require oral testing in order to show what they know for their assessment. And we have recorders. And so now the AI is coming in where they can actually transcribe the responses and the student doesn't have to sit and write because they're never going to get all of their knowledge out on paper. And instead they can speak into a tech tool and then that transcribes and that's sent to the teacher and the teacher can determine how much the student has understood of the content. So we are using quite a bit of this technology. We want our students to use it correctly. We don't want them to over-rely on the tools and to be able to use them ethically in a way.
Mm-hmm. So we see all this discussion about AI lately, mm-hmm. and we see that, you know, the first response or the first instinct of everybody is like, you know, how do I prevent cheating or mm-hmm. how do I prevent ready-made questions being a ready-made answer situation mm-hmm. where, you know, you don't know how to evaluate a student if they use this kind of techniques. In the case of special learning or optimal learning, do you think that this is a concern? Do you think that there are other things that we're looking forward to see through AI?
Well, we are very fortunate. We have an OLP testing center. And so there is somebody working with the students at all times when they have an assessment, if the student chooses to come to us for the assessment. And so it's almost a personal experience with our OLP test supervisor because he asks the question, he's watching, he's making sure that there isn't the cheating that we might expect. And so there is that connection with somebody during an assessment.
Mm-hmm. And since you mentioned the diagnostic center that we have, what is the role of the work done in this center in the development of the, as we call them, individualized educational plans, IEPs, that are tailored to meet the unique child, the unique needs of the child? Where does the role of the parent fit in this process? What kind of partnerships do we have to engage in?
All right. Let me go back just real quickly. Before, when I mentioned the assessment center, that's the OLP testing center. It's not the diagnostic center. And so we have somebody who's supervising assessments on a daily basis from period to period. I was referring to that. Now, the diagnostic center plays an invaluable role in our work because that's where those conversations begin. When the parents are vital components of the student's success, if they understand the learning needs of their child, if they're in agreement and if they're in partnership with us, because we need to have that golden triangle that we keep talking about. Without the parents, we're working just internally with the school and then there's no carryover. There's no consistency mm-hmm. for the student. Mm-hmm. And so those conversations start with the diagnostic center, and then we continue them. We continue them through the ILP when we design those. And the ILP mirrors the psychoeducation assessment, which the parents have gone through with our diagnosticians, and then they review it with us. So when we're looking at the ILP, it's a summary and a review of what they've experienced already in their understanding of their child's needs. And I think all of these partnerships with the counselors, with the diagnostic center, the OLP specialists, parents, everybody who's involved is going on the same track, on the same path. And the whole focus is to support the learner.
Have you seen cases where you see a diagnosis from either outside or inside mm-hmm. diagnostic tests mm-hmm. that, you know, in the way when the student comes in the school and you have already put the IEP together mm-hmm. and you say something is off or something was not 100% what is presented to me through the IEP. Have you seen false positives? I mean, I don't know if this is a term.
No, I don't think we have false positives. We do have growth. And I must say our diagnostic assessments are just exceptional. Absolutely. So there's 200% trust in what comes out from there. We do get reports from other centers.
Or false negatives.
Okay. The scores. I think the scores have to match up. The trickiest part is what are the recommendations and do they match up with the
results?
With the accommodations and the results? Because accommodations pretty much lead up to the IB policy for inclusion. Mm-hmm. And so our students have to get reassessed every 3 years. So maybe
as they grow, as they develop their skills, maybe some of those concerns or areas of difficulty that they experienced in their previous assessment won't be there mm-hmm. as heavily anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's why we want current information so that we know what we're working on specifically. So it's not necessarily a false negative or a false positive. It's more of how is the student developing while their brain is also developing? How are they growing? And how can we adjust that recipe of support that we have?
You are listening to the Owlcast, the official podcast of ACS Athens.
Today with us is Sarah Caldelli, Optimal Learning Program Coordinator at ACS Athens. Stay with us as we continue our discussion about psychoeducational testing, IEPs, and other customizations in student learning. The inclusion model in education, expanding the frontiers, and the intentional deviation from the norms, and from underdiagnosing to compensating for learning differences. Chris Barak is the coordinator of the program for many, many years since it was called Optimal Match, mm-hmm. as you said before, has frequently quoted Ignacio Estrada, who has said that if a child can't learn the way we teach, maybe we should teach the way they learn. In my mind, I'm reminded of a comic that shows someone telling a bunch of different animals,
yes.
a monkey, a penguin, an elephant, a fish in a bowl, a seal, and a dog, that for first election, everybody has to take the same exam.
Yes.
Please climb the tree.
Yes.
So there is also a famous quote from George Evans who said, every child can learn, just not on the same day or in the same way. It's not that students don't want to learn. They're just not being taught in a way that they can learn. So the question is, what is fair? How can education be differentiated to reach all students in your mind?
Well, I'd like to also bring, due to the recent conference that we have, and I attended Dr. Sugarman's talk, and she even said that we're continuing in a model of education that was created at a time that doesn't necessarily match up with our time now. And we're confined by this model. The structure is there, and we're trying to find pathways out of it. But what we try and do in OLP, Optimal Learning Program, is to try and identifies those slight ways that we can deviate from just what is taught to the classroom. And our teachers are great at doing this, but some students just, indeed, they need options, they need choices, they need to know that I don't have to do this now, but I might have to do it later. And when I do it later, I'm going to have these tools that will help me. And the other thing is, it does take a tremendous amount of patience. And sometimes we see growth in those moments that aren't evident to every eye. But then when you work with the students over years and you see just how exceptionally hard they've worked to get where they are, and when they have those aha moments, you know that all these little bits are helping and they're getting the support that they need.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the conference for inclusion that mm-hmm. we hosted on March 17 and 18. That was a conference for inclusion of the Educational Collaborative for International Schools, ECIS. Our community participated and attended workshops there, discussion forums, presentations from experts like Dr. Sugarman on inclusive education. Inclusion, diversity, equity are some of the terms that will be spoken of in the years to come. What are your key takeaways from this conference?
I think it was a wonderful conference. So many interesting people attended and so many interesting workshops. Well, my takeaway were so many, actually, from admissions to how we speak to students, how we make sure that we're using inclusive language. And pretty much what we all want, everybody at that conference, is to support students, to make them feel like they belong. And that's our key thing. Make them feel that they can be confident, that they can learn to be confident, that they have abilities. There's so many takeaways. I don't know if I can take one.
Something that you heard and you say, oh, I'm going to put this into action next time I have a session or I have a discussion with a colleague.
I think we'll all remember Sheffield and the hills and buying that bicycle that Dr. Sobel talked about, you know, instead of adding more content during lunchtime, what that student needed was a bike to get to school quicker,
mm-hmm.
right? And so maybe we should all be thinking of what bicycle does this student need? Not necessarily a metaphorical bicycle, but it doesn't always have to be the clear-cut solution. Mm-hmm. And we need to think of imaginative, creative, new ways to support them instead of just saying, okay, let's add on more sessions of a content area.
I think the age of clear-cut solutions is over.
Yeah.
And yeah. It's up to us to figure out one of the solutions, how it can be employed in our case, in mm-hmm. each individual case. Mm-hmm. Well, we offer, ACS Athens offers learning support to neurodiverse students for many years now. As far as I know, from the 70s, there has been a resource room, or mm-hmm. as I've heard it called, the room under the stairs.
Yes.
Now, the Optimal Learning Program offers more kinds of support in different modalities, frequencies, variety of tools. What is the main question or concern you have when you review a student file? Whether this is of a new applicant or a newly referred case from our teachers urging the program for assistance?
I think the main concern is how knowledgeable, aware, and open the parents are to their child's needs. Because many times we have parents who say, oh, no, they don't have anything, the difficulty isn't there, but we have it documented. And then you understand that the collaboration and that partnership isn't going to be full, because if there's a wall there, then we can't openly talk about what a child needs. And then there's just a constant block that you have to work against for the duration of the child's enrollment in the school. So if you don't have parents as your partner, it becomes difficult to support the child.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the different accommodations and supports that we are offering to the neurodiverse students, and how can a student access them?
So in order to get all of these accommodations that I've just mentioned, students have to be enrolled in the Optimal Learning Program. And what does that mean? We have various different levels that we offer of support. The full class of OLP means that a student in middle school and academy will not necessarily have an elective and will go to the OLP classroom for a block for that period. So three times a week, close to the hour. In elementary school, it works a little bit different because we take the students from the area that they're developing. So if their class is doing writing, then the student will go to the OLP classroom and do writing. Whether that's with in a small group, there might be a different grade level in the room at the same time because we have two professionals working there. And then everybody is working exactly at the level that they're doing. Full class sometimes can also be a push-in where the OLP specialist or the OLP aide goes into the classroom and supports students, not only in OLP, but also in the regular classroom
in collaboration with the teacher.
So that's full class. And then we have OLP consultation. OLP consultation takes place once a week for approximately 20 minutes. It's always more than that, John. And then
Is it more than one time a week, maybe?
It could be sometimes. Could be. And then we monitor the students' progress. We work with organization. What I like to call it is the safety net. OLP consultation is a safety net for the students. There's a lot of communication with teachers. We make sure that accommodations are in place.
And I assume this is a kind of accommodation for older students mostly, correct? Or no?
Yes, there's way more in middle school and academy, fewer in elementary.
Because they have gone through the regular spectrum of support,
yes,
correct?
Yes, yeah. And then we have the ISP, which is the individual support plan. And this level of support doesn't offer any contact with an OLP specialist.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a concern, parents, teachers, or the student themselves can approach OLP and say, hey, I have this concern, or this isn't working, or can you help me with? Then we also have OLP inclusion, and that is the pairing of a special ed teacher, the inclusion specialist, with a content area teacher. And they co-teach, they co-plan, and they make sure, and not just for students in OLP, but for all, that those differentiation techniques are happening in the classroom. The OLP inclusion specialist also works closely with our child study team, or CST, And when teachers raise concerns for students, maybe they're not accessing the curriculum, maybe they need additional support in something, then the OOP inclusion specialist will go work with that teacher specifically and again offer those differentiation techniques for all the students. Because if it will work for ours, it will work for all. So those are the two different models of that we have for inclusion. And then we also have the shadow teacher program, and those are for students who have just slightly more needs and need that assistance in the classroom, whether to just stay focused, whether to complete work, maybe it's to access the curriculum. Those are all the levels of support. All students in OOP must have current psychoeducational assessment. And by current, we say every 3 years, a student has to be reassessed. Accommodations can range from extended time on a test that we provide to having a reader for a test, having a scribe, going back and doing just a lot of review and repetition, small changes in the classroom setting where a teacher can give signals, where they can create maybe a word bank would just be helpful. And so even through the inclusion model that we have with our inclusion specialist, those are team collaborations with teachers, and the inclusion specialist goes in and makes observations, and then they see what would benefit all students, not just the ones that are in OOP, but what helps our students in OOP could help all of them. And so there's all the accommodations are, again, you've got to find the bicycle for each of them.
I like that metaphor. Yeah. I'm going to be using it. in the years I have seen and reviewed applications for admissions, I have seen a clear shift from trying to hide children's neurodiversity from the parents themselves, as though it's a stigma that someone learns differently, to what now is a proactive approach to maybe over-diagnose or over-treat special skills. Have you seen cases from your experience of students who are diagnosed with neurodiverse abilities but are able to mainstream without any intervention?
Well, yes. I mean, I could say that we've seen all cases. The question, have you seen a case where, I would most likely say, yes, we have seen. It's rare these days that we can say, no, whoa, we haven't seen that before. So we do have students, and it's called the compensation. They can compensate for the area of difficulty, and they learn to do that from a very young age. We have students in our school who only recently, they might be in 10th grade, 11th grade, and only recently have been assessed, and it's been found that they have reading difficulties. And apparently they were not able to mask it, but their brain compensated for the difficulty, and it didn't necessarily show in the school setting until they were tested with very specific standardized assessments. So yes, we see all ranges. We also see students who we have significant concerns about, but then due to that collaboration with the parents, or the lack of collaboration with the parents, the students don't get accommodations, they don't get the support, and then they struggle significantly throughout.
Can you share examples of success stories of neurodiverse students that have gone through the program, and why would you consider them a success?
I consider all of our students to be successes personally. So if I've been doing this for so many years, I would have thousands of success stories to share, but they go on to college, they major in things that they're interested, they follow their passions. Success stories are for students who come into the third grade and they might have zero English proficiency, no words. Maybe they know the word balloon. For some reason, they all know yellow and red. And then you've got to work maybe dog, cat. They could even have the level of support through a shadow teacher. And then they slowly progress. And by the time they get to maybe 9th grade, 10th grade, they're fluent English speakers. They're accessing most of the curriculum independently. They still need some tools. I mean, that's a huge success. I had a student who came in the third grade that spoke zero English, no words, not even cat or yellow. And then right now they're in, I would say, 10th or 11th grade, completely independent. They're on the lowest level of support, which is our ISP, individual support plan, doesn't use accommodations ever, and is most likely going on to succeed hugely in life. And so I can't pick who's more successful than the other. They all are.
Does the fact that someone does not speak the language affect the way that their special talent or special ability is expressed. I mean, we have kids that have dyslexia, for example, in one language. Coming to a different language curriculum, does this particular dyslexia, is it affected by that change in the language of the curriculum, do you think?
Sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. It really depends on the individual student. We've got to kind of identify whether we're talking about a specific learning difference in written expression. What about written expression? Is it reading comprehension? Is it reading fluency? So the term dyslexia now is a little bit, it's broad now. It's not...
What's the term now?
Well, you have to have a specific learning difference in a certain area. Dyslexia was a term used in the DSM, but yeah, now it's very...
Excuse my use of the word. I know that everything has changed.
But. Yeah, it's everything has changed. But then again, you know, dyslexia did encompass all of these different things.
Right, right.
And so when we're talking about a specific learning difference in reading comprehension, it could be all sort. That's really tricky to support because they're not making mental pictures of what they're reading. And so if you don't have those images of what you're reading, if you're not making that abstraction from the written code, that's difficult to get to that point. So we just have to be mindful of what everybody needs.
Recently, you participated in the CIS Child Protection and Safeguarding Conference in The Hague, and you have actively assisted in creating the ACES Athens Handbook on the subject. The importance of safety and protection of children is self-evident and undoubtful. Why do you think this ties in so closely in your role in special education?
First of all, that conference just completely changed my life. And they said that the first sentence they said as the conference began is, "You will not leave here the same person," and totally delivered on that one. It ties in because if you look at the students that are kind of marginalized, who are in not a weaker position, but in a position of being not victimized necessarily, safeguarding comes into that. And students with learning differences and disabilities, special needs, fall into some of those categories, as do, unfortunately, in this world, students who may be part of the LGBTQ community, students who of a lower socioeconomic range. So there are groupings of people who are more easily accessed by people who wish them harm.
Thank you so much for being with us, Sarah Caldelli. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thank you.
You are listening to The Owlcast, the official podcast of ACS Athens. Make sure you subscribe to The Owlcast on Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. This has been a production of the ACS Athens Media Studio.